Why does the government deliberately go so far out of its way, to Switzerland no less, to find someone else's misstatement of the bullion depository modifications so that they can attack that instead of refuting our own statements? If they can refute our actual charges, why don't they do it? I invite the government to listen to my monthly audio letter number 2 for July 1975 and respond to that, not someone else's second-hand statements. As I clearly stated then, the central core vault was built into the depository at the start. Major Tatum's job later on was to build a rapid retrieval system into the gold vault, not to build the vault itself. I also explained that there is a gap of 6 digits, not 12, on each floor of vault compartments. My friend, the government is acutely aware of my real charges, so why don't they answer them? What do you think? Notice also, in trying to wave aside references to Major Stanley Tatum, how cleverly it is done. We can prove that he was there and did oversee the work in the, on the rapid retrieval system. And apparently the government knows we can. Therefore, the following sentence is used to mislead without actually lying. And I quote, "We have no record of Major Stanley Tatum designing or overseeing the construction of our central core vault," unquote. Of course they don't, because that is just not what he did. He built a rapid retrieval system to give access to the central core vault. The writers of the letter included one other item, which was intended to help throw everyone off the track, but actually does just the opposite. According to our own sources, during the work on the rapid retrieval system in 1942 and 43, the disruption was so great that the gold was taken out of the central core vault and, quote, "piled around in the corridors," unquote. Now we are told in this letter about the strange corridor door which was installed for unstated reasons. Listen again to these astonishing words from Mrs. Brooks' letter, and I quote, "This work was completed on January 7, 1942, and the number 15 was assigned to the door. After this work was completed, gold was stored in the corridor for a time, during which the door was locked and sealed," unquote. Mrs. Brooks does not tell us for how long a time, much less why. But thanks to our own information, she doesn't have to tell us. I suggest that you replay Mrs. Brooks' letter all the way through and see for yourself what you will pick up. For example, listen to all the assertions and denials that are all couched in the words, quote, "our records show," unquote, or, quote, "we have no record," unquote. This coming from the same office whose records are so suspect in other ways. Records of the quality of gold stored in Fort Knox and elsewhere, as I have revealed on other occasions, have disagreed with one another in glaring ways. The official mint records omit shipments we can prove from Fort Knox. Even the case of the missing experimental aluminum pennies that has erupted lately is another example of the dependability of United States mint records. But notice also that the letter spends the least time on the most important matter of all, the radioactive plutonium poison stored in the central core of vault. It is stated that the radiation test by the military, quote, "did not disclose any evidence of radioactive material," unquote. In much the same vein, and with similar bureaucratic phrases like, quote, "we have no evidence," unquote, the Kentucky Department of Human Resources claims that there is nothing to worry about. But, my friend, plutonium radiation is very hard to detect, yet very deadly if it gets inside your body. Experts sum it up with the phrase, "if there is enough plutonium to detect, it is already too much." Therefore, nothing less than a serious, comprehensive, honest check by top experts with the best equipment available can be considered satisfactory. The stakes for over 36 million Americans in the southeast United States are too high to settle for less. The United States government expects you to just take their word for it, regardless of what they may tell you. No proof, no criteria, just believe what they say. Well, my friend, I do not ask you to do that. I am now going to issue a challenge to the federal government, either to confirm or refute my charges about the plutonium poison leaking from the bullion depository at Fort Knox, openly, fairly, and conclusively. Furthermore, I'm going to state clearly what my criteria are for a test of my charges that I believe the American people could accept and believe in. Here specifically is what I propose. First, formation of a truly blue ribbon committee to test for plutonium poison leakage from the bullion depository at Fort Knox. This committee to consist of scientists, recognized authorities, fully qualified for such a task. If my challenge is accepted, the committee must include certain individuals whose names I will reveal at that time. The government may nominate an equal number of scientists to the committee. However, my nominees will be men who are not my employees or associates. And likewise, any members of the committee nominated by the government must not be federal employees unless my own information indicates that they can be trusted. In other words, the committee must be independent and totally unbiased. Second, this committee is to be given complete authority and discretion over the conduct of the plutonium poison investigation. They are to be provided, at federal government expense, with any and all technical assistance they may request, as well as the most up-to-date and effective instrumentation. This must include the 1026 multi-channel analyzer and any other devices they may specify. They must also have the right, by majority vote of the committee, to add other experts to their investigating committee if they deem it necessary. They are not to be interfered with or limited in any way. Should federal or other authorities choose to impose limitations, the investigating committee shall be empowered to immediately state any objections they may have to these limitations over live nationwide television and radio so that their message cannot be edited out or reinterpreted by anyone else. Third, upon completion of their investigation, the investigating committee shall be granted up to 1 hour of live broadcast time on nationwide radio and television to present their findings and also their recommendations if my charges are confirmed. I am willing to accept their conclusion as final if it is unanimous, and the federal government must agree to do the same. There is no time to be lost. If you agree that my proposal is reasonable, start passing the word and applying public opinion pressure to make it happen. Otherwise, the ever-expanding control exercised by the Rockefeller brothers will prevent it. It is up to you, because the once free, once great major media in America are being gobbled up ever more completely by the Rockefellers. Their latest victim is the mighty Hearst Publishing Empire, whose publications reach a total audience of nearly 86 million adults. This takeover is the bottom line in the tragic Patty Hearst case involving the CIA-financed SLA, a stock transfer to a tax-free foundation controlled by the Rockefellers, was the objective, and it has now been accomplished. It's sad that we have to look overseas to see any meaningful reporting about the Fort Knox plutonium disaster. In the Financial Times of London for Thursday, December 11, 1975, the story was broken by C. Gordon Tether, whose financial column is read the world over. In his article titled A New Twist of Fort Knox Saga, he reviews the Fort Knox gold scandal cover-up and then informs his readers of the latest charges concerning plutonium. He ends the article with words that no columnist of his stature in America has yet dared to write. And I quote, "But whatever the cost in terms of loss of face, Might not the United States authorities be well advised to do whatever is necessary to demonstrate that there is no Fort Knox cover-up? In the light of what has happened in the United States during the past few years, deeds inevitably now speak louder than words, and a refusal to prove that they have nothing to hide is inevitably destined to go on fostering precisely the opposite impression. Unquote. Topic number two. On December 11, 1975, New York City went into default. Hundreds of millions of dollars in city notes came due on that day, and the city did not pay as promised. A default is nothing more or less than a failure to pay, and that's exactly what happened. But wait a minute, you may say. President Ford announced that he would ask Congress to give New York City $2.3 billion in loans because New York bailed itself out. What's going on here? What is going on, my friend, is just another Rockefeller shell game. New York City has declared a three-year moratorium, so-called, on payment of $1.6 billion of city notes. Anyone holding one of those notes cannot cash it in for 3 years and will also receive a lowered rate of interest during that time. New York note holders do have another choice, though. Until December 29, a few days from now, these note holders may, if they wish, trade their notes for bonds issued by the Municipal Assistance Corporation, or otherwise known as MAC, on behalf of New York City. These bonds cannot be cashed in for 10 years or more, but they carry a higher rate of interest. And oh yes, there's one other little uncertainty. MAC is a so-called moral obligation agency, an idea given birth by Nelson Rockefeller and his own lawyer, John Mitchell, and its bonds are moral obligation bonds. Its promise to pay the bonds when they come due is not backed up by a legal obligation on the part of New York City, New York State, or anyone else. Either way, the person who simply wants to cash in his city note as it comes due is now out of luck. He can't do it. So New York City is in default. Don't be misled by the fact that the major media under Rockefeller control are not using that word default for the time being. As I pointed out last month in my monthly audio letter number 6, the dress rehearsal for default in New York some weeks ago was used to give that word default a very apocalyptic meaning. The word is therefore being saved for the right moment. Meanwhile, the effect of this New York failure to pay is already spreading through our economy. Municipalities all over America and even abroad are suddenly finding it hard to sell their bonds. As the municipal bond market dries up, so will funds for public employees, projects, and so forth. The domino effect has already started, but our advanced revelations have made it dangerous for them to highlight this just yet. But you can be sure that the word default has not been so carefully given its present frightening connotations without a purpose. And it may be that we will all see that purpose within a matter of a few days. A court ruling is due soon concerning the constitutionality of the so-called moratorium imposed by New York. Should it be ruled unconstitutional, financial chaos will be the result in New York, and that chaos will quickly be labeled default. There are a whole string of other time bombs like that too, all ticking away. When the time is just right, the Rockefeller brothers can set off whichever one is the handiest. When they do, the results will be the same, regardless of the exact timing. Armed with this knowledge, I hope you have taken the necessary steps to protect yourself, such as I described in my audio book number 1 on how to protect yourself during the coming Depression and Third World War. Meanwhile, gradualism continues to be the word for the step-by-step actions of the Rockefeller brothers. So if you watch the stock market, for example, don't fall into the trap of reading great significance into the daily up and down wiggles. What counts is the month-to-month trend, and that is down. The stock market crash actually began in July 1975, as I said it would, but it does not yet suit the purposes of the Rockefeller brothers for this to be obvious to all. Instead, the overall market is sinking downward in gradual, almost imperceptible phases. It is crashing in slow motion, like a bad dream. Meanwhile, most people, that is, those who do not specialize in the stock market and financial matters, generally keep track of little more than the Dow Jones Industrial Average. There are nearly 2,000 stocks traded on the New York Stock Exchange, but the Dow Index is an average of just 30 of them. They were chosen to be representative of the whole market, assuming no manipulation, but that assumption is no longer correct. Very special attention is paid to the manipulation of prices of these 30 stocks. As a result, the real behavior of the market can be completely hidden from the general public. Wherever man is involved, races will be fixed. Turning to the monetary picture, a development I first revealed in April of this year has just happened. At the 1975 International Gold and Monetary Conference here in Washington, D.C., I revealed confidential information to the effect that the Soviet Union would soon be issuing an international gold ruble. And just a few days ago, it happened. The Soviet Union has introduced their Chervonets, Chervonetz, or 10-ruble gold piece. It bears the date 1975, and only 250,000 have been minted, 50,000 which are already here in the United States, out of 125,000 to be consigned to the United States. Under a 1923 Soviet law, it is legal tender, making it convertible. This new gold coin is an attempt by the Russians for the first time in 52 years to penetrate the world gold coin market and to compete directly with the Kruger Rand issued by South Africa. The Chervonets is about one quarter the size and value of the Kruger Rand, which means South Africa will have to take measures to compete with it. The other major event, supposedly in the monetary sphere, is the monetary conference, so-called, at Rambouillet Castle near Paris late last month. It was a summit meeting of the Big Six, the United States, France, Britain, West Germany, Italy, and Japan. But please note that Canada was not there, and for very good reasons. First, here's what happened. Then I will explain why it happened, which is far more important. Treasury Secretary Simon said on his way back from the meeting, which took place over the weekend of November 16, 1975, that a compromise had been reached on exchange rates, among other things. France wanted fixed rates, while the United States had been campaigning for a free float to continue. The compromise that was reached is just what I had told you it would be, stable yet flexible rates of exchange, which they chose to call a managed float. Simon also said he hoped that, quote, the agreement will be approved at an international meeting in January, and that Congress will readily approve necessary changes in the articles governing the operation of the International Monetary Fund, unquote. Now, a managed float, from a legal point of view, does not require any change in the articles that govern the IMF, unless it changes the par value of gold. So what is brewing now is a system of so-called stable yet flexible rates of exchange, indirectly tied to a par value of gold. I revealed in my monthly audio letter number 5 for October 1975 that the plan is to repeg gold at or about $195 per ounce. And this is still on track. This, in effect, will amount to still another devaluation of the dollar. And the official price of gold, $42.22, will be abolished beginning early next year. Keep in mind that the private gold markets will not be closed. And after this action, private gold prices will go past the $195 mark. A leapfrog condition will have been set in motion that will jack the price of gold higher and higher, and the process will be intensified by the coming war and worldwide economic problems. David Rockefeller's gold skyrocket will be launched at last, but the 50 million ounces of gold to be sold by the IMF will never reach the private market, going instead to the central bankers by way of sale, auction, or restitution. 5 million ounces of this returned to the United States under the restitution provision will be used in an attempt to continue to cover up the Fort Knox gold scandal, along with gold now being smuggled into the United States by the CIA for the private coffers of the Rockefeller brothers. The biggest question about Rambouillet is, why did the United States compromise? The answer is that a free floating system would be too uncontrollable during the upcoming limited nuclear war against the Arab OPEC nations, which is targeted to begin late in February 1976, just 2 months from now. So the United States had to compromise to complete its preparations for this war. What I am telling you, my friend, is a military secret, or was until I revealed it in detail in my monthly audio letter number 6 last month. The code name for this military attack, by the way, is Operation Cobra, and preparations for it are moving rapidly. Already, the first detachment of crack United States Marines are now in Germany, ready for swift deployment into the Sinai, where war will break out. And the build-up toward the staged provocation to ignite the conflict, namely an attack on the so-called American advisors in the Sinai, is progressing steadily. Only today, December 21, 1975, the latest step was taken in this plan when a CIA-supported group made a provocative attack on OPEC oil ministers at their headquarters in Vienna, Austria. This is intended to lead by stages to reprisal actions against the Americans stationed in the Sinai. Now I turn briefly to topic number 3. As I explained last month, the limited nuclear war, which is scheduled to begin soon in the Middle East, is only a part of a much larger picture. The Rockefeller brothers have designs on India, while the Soviet Union has its eyes on China. In resource-rich Africa, both the Rockefellers and their Soviet allies have an interest. So the real theater in the war now brewing is Asia. After the OPEC oil wells are capped by the nuclear strike, Russia's western flank, Europe, will be crippled, and Africa will be more easily finished off by the guerrilla warfare already going on there. Oil-hungry Japan will be thrown into the arms of Red China, which, by the way, has just announced it can now export oil. And the stage will be set for the big Asian war that is to be the next round in the bloody game of global monopoly. The strategy of all this was spelled out in my monthly audio letter number 6 last month. My purpose now, however, is simply to point out the basic nature of all this. It is, my friend, a drive for control, control of people, of resources, of the entire world. Furthermore, it is the product of an unholy alliance between the state socialists and the Soviet Union and the corporate socialists in the United States, the Rockefeller brothers and their client followers. Many people mistake the Rockefeller brothers for capitalists, but that is not at all what they are. David Rockefeller, for example, has been quoted as saying, "I believe in the enterprise system," unquote. But he does not say free, much less competitive enterprise. The entire Rockefeller empire is built on the exact opposite of that, monopolies and trusts. Their major multinational corporations are an ingenious device for casting off loyalties to any country, and they are already more powerful collectively than most nations. The Rockefellers, you see, are corporate socialists. Corporate socialism and state socialism are nothing more than two sides of the same coin. Both boil down to the same thing: dictatorships or near dictatorships, enabling a very few people to control everyone else. Once you grasp this fact, the alliance between the Rockefellers and the Soviets will no longer surprise you. Nor will the fact that the Russian Revolution in 1917 was financed by the Rockefeller interests. The state socialism of Nazi Germany also falls into place, since it too was just another version of the same pattern. In all of these cases, as well as many others we see today, the corporate socialist empire of the Rockefeller brothers gains handsomely: mineral riches, oil, and other rewards in return for cooperation with state socialism. Thus it is that Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, a Rockefeller agent for 20 years and more, defends the Soviet Union against charges of cheating on the so-called Salt Arms Limitation Agreement. that allows his outgoing ambassador to Canada to publicly accuse our closest neighbor of being no longer reliable or to be trusted. Kissinger speaks, not for you or me, but for the Rockefeller brothers. And to them, Russia is the ally, the friend, while our close friends in Canada are the enemy, the people not to be trusted. Because Canada's government now knows what is in the wind, and they are taking all the necessary steps to weather the storm. The Canadian government wants no part of the coming war, monetary chaos, and all the rest of it, and has privately said so to Kissinger in no uncertain terms. So Canada has become unreliable, which means outside the circle of firm Rockefeller control. Bravo for Canada. Long may she continue on her independent course. Ultimately, the greedy misdeeds of the Rockefeller brothers and their allies will be their eventual undoing. Even now, both Nelson Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger have doomed themselves by handling some of the gold that was taken out of Fort Knox. That gold was contaminated by the radioactive plutonium-239 super poison, and now their bodies are contaminated with it. Even though they and the rest of the Rockefeller organization may well succeed in destroying our republic if we do not act, they will not live long to enjoy it. What poetic justice! Their dose is even stronger than that received by the congressmen and newsmen who visited the bullion depository at Fort Knox in September 1974. Yes, eventually, the huge empire of the Rockefeller brothers and their allies will tear itself apart and perhaps destroy the world in the process. But meanwhile, if we do not act now, there will be untold suffering for millions, ourselves, our children, and probably our children's children. Can we possibly sit by and let that happen? Or do we act now, while we still can, and take back our rightful control over our own destinies? For me, there can be only one choice, and I hope for you as well. Until next month, this is Dr. Beter. I wish all of you a blessed Christmas and a healthy, happy, holy New Year. May God bless each and every one of you.